We're going to put like jingle bells at the front of this. Make it all silly and cheesy. Maybe we'll have to now that I thought of that.
Yeah.
Draw them in. Bait and switch.
I love those jingle bells.
We often think about Christmas as a New Testament story.
Ah, that's the problem.
I'm wondering, does it start earlier than that?
Yeah. So we almost think of Christmas as like, it's a new thing that's come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But it's from the very beginning, we get this sense that that a child is going to somehow interrupt the flow of cosmic events and change things. So, yeah. Okay. So where does that start? I guess the question is where do children come into the story of salvation or changing,
right?
You know, or interrupting the plans of the evil? Well, that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, right? Mm-hmm. So the very first thing, what is this you've done? He curses the serpent, asks the woman, what's this you've done? And he says, I'm going to put an enemy between you and the woman. This is to the serpent. And he says, between your children and her children, he shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. It's really unclear exactly what that means.
Right.
But at the very least, it means he's going to use her children to go to war with the serpent, whoever the serpent character is, who's just an adversary against God and his plans at this point. So it's interesting from the very beginning, he doesn't say, I'm going to bring a powerful king into the universe who's going to stomp you. He says, her children are going to become your problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how it was supposed to go, is the children of, we eventually find out, of Abraham, who are eventually going to bring us to what I consider the Christmas story in the Old Testament, which is Exodus 1. It's a story about a baby who is born in a circumstance of adversity where there's a king hunting him and his kind out to kill the male babies. And the reason the king wants to kill all the male babies is because he's afraid that these people will rise up against him in a time of turmoil. And so he hunts or tries to get them killed. It doesn't work out so well. And this is a very famous pattern in ancient Near Eastern stories where some god or some king gets worried about these people or maybe a particular person who's born, that this person is going to be a problem for them. So the mother of that person sends that person away into obscurity in order to be raised off-site and then come back, and then they come back later as the powerful figure grown up. The very thing the king was scared of happens to them. So we have modern stories like Harry Potter, I'm told. I haven't read all the Harry Potters, but I'm, you know, he's raised in obscurity because Voldemort's worried about him because of a prophecy about him being born. Who else? Luke Skywalker is sent off to the moisture farm because Darth Vader, his father, maybe, I don't remember who sends him off, but I know he's raised off in obscurity and then he comes back in power. We have ancient stories about this too. The Egyptian story of Horus, the hawk-headed god, is hidden away from Osiris by his mother Isis. And Isis takes the little baby Osiris, these are gods, right? Mm-hmm. But she takes him and she builds a basket out of reeds and coats it with tar and pitch and then puts it in the Nile River where he's raised, I believe, by a farmer somewhere off in obscurity and then comes back to enter the pantheon of God. So we're actually very used to the story of a baby becoming powerful, right? Or people being scared of babies because babies represent the children who will cause them problems. Mm-hmm. And then so in Exodus, we have a particular baby who represents all the babies who will grow up to give Pharaoh problems in the Pharaoh's mind. And of course, that baby is rescued by being sent off in the Nile, just like Horus or Sargon in the Mesopotamian version. And he's raised not really in obscurity. He's raised within Pharaoh's own house. The very person who tried to have him killed, he's raised in his house against the will of the Pharaoh. We don't really know how he feels about it or if he knows about it. And then he goes off and he has to run away even further because he ends up killing an Egyptian in defense of his Hebrew brothers and sisters. And then he eventually, when that king dies, that Pharaoh dies, he comes back and God calls him to come free Israel from the house of slavery in Egypt. So it's a baby who's born under adverse circumstances, who rises to power and then saves, basically. It's not just that it's a similar story, but that Jesus' story itself is, it seems to be patterned off of Moses. So when we turn to especially Luke's telling of Jesus' story, same problem, a king who hears, this time he hears a prophecy from foreigners that there's this king to be born. He investigates it. He orders the execution of these children. And of course, a lot of people think this is like thousands of children being slaughtered. It'd probably be a dozen at most in a small hamlet. I say at most, it's still a horrible order for a king to give. A king that murdered some of his own sons because he was afraid his own sons were going to take the throne from him. So it's not like Herod wasn't the kind of guy who would order the murder of children. He murdered his own children. So interestingly, where does Jesus go in order to be hidden away? Into Egypt. Until that king dies, which is when he comes back, according to Luke. So they had to wait till Herod died, and then he comes back in the land. He grows up in the land like any other Jewish boy in Galilee, and eventually kind of makes his public stage of a let my people go. But his let my people go is, I've come to let my people go. I don't need the permission of a king. I don't need the permission of the Roman emperor. I've come to do all of this. And he kind of is both living into all of these stories and then flipping them on their head in so many ways. So it's not like this is the first time anybody who's been reading scripture has ever heard of this idea, right? So I guess why is Christmas then so significant? If it's just another instance, right? Yeah, we've seen this before. Yeah. Why do people make such a big deal out of Christmas? I always have to point out because Christmas is not a holiday. It's not a holy day. It's not commanded to be celebrated. Right. The early church even had some misgivings about whether you should celebrate it. The Protestant church, much of the Protestant church did not believe in celebrating Christmas. The Puritan, I mean, there's various groups of people that have been adamant against celebrating Christmas because it's not in Scripture. So I guess the question is, why would we make a big deal, even if we want to say about Advent, not just the day of Christmas, but why is it different, I guess?
I think about it as different because, A, I've never really thought about the Exodus story being a little mini Christmas story before, and then also you turn the page and then you're in a New Testament, and so you think about it as distinct from what has come before.
Yeah, the book format itself.
Right.
If we're rolling out scrolls and comparing these things, it might seem less blocky than if it's a book where you're progressing through the pages and you think, okay, the new part has come, so we're done with that old part, so we don't need to go back there.
There's like a blank page in the middle.
But there are hyperlinks going throughout connecting the two together, right? So, and I think all the prophets, you know, the inkling, even in Genesis 3, they call it the Proto-Evangelion, the Genesis 3:15. Her children are going to be an enemy of you, the serpent. Proto-Evangelion is just the fancy way of saying the first gospel.
Yeah.
It's the first good news. So before God curses the woman, he already announces in advance, her children are going to fight against you. And we figure out very quickly that God's going to enable her children to fight against Satan in the most powerful ways possible, calling Abraham, creating the nation of Israel through him, which then creates justice and peace in the land. That's what it was supposed to do before it all went off the rails. But they were supposed to establish justice for the poor, for the vulnerable, for the sojourner, and to do things rightly in the land, and God would protect them in that way. And so we see when Jesus comes, he's going to be a prince of peace. He's going to be a governor, right? And so we like to think of him as, I think of Jesus as mostly a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's what most people say. Yeah, he was a good teacher. Mm-hmm. He's a good rabbi.
Yeah.
or healer, you know, somebody who had control of nature. But if you look at why does Jesus have control of nature, why does he have ultimate authority to teach, and everything he says is true, it's as true and as good and solid as God's words himself, it's because he's going to be a governor. He's going to rule with an iron scepter. He's going to be fully in charge and, you know, large and in charge, as you would say. And so just like that Pharaoh who looked at baby Hebrew boys and he didn't see baby Hebrew boys, he saw future political adversaries who could ruin the whole Egypt empire show. In some ways, you know, in a positive spin on that, when we think about Jesus as coming as an infant, and it seems to be what Mary understood, you know, she treasured these things up in her heart. Everywhere it says she's treasured these things up in her heart, she understood this is what God was doing, is that when she looked at this boy, she realized this actually is the ruler of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. And that's why she seems to have unique insights into what Jesus is doing. I'll just read a little bit from her song, which in part two we'll talk about how her song relates to the Old Testament. But her song, which we call the Magnificat, which is her kind of song of praise that matches another song in the Hebrew Bible. But you see, she thinks about this child, and what does she say? His mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has sown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud, the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of humble estate. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he was sent away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, and he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham, and to his offspring, his children, forever. She connects the two things together there, that he's going to politically reign over mm-hmm, the world, mm-hmm. and that he does it for the sake of the vulnerable, mm-hmm. To make sure that all justice is kept across the board, that everybody is treated well, that everything is put to rights, as Tom Wright likes to say. Yeah. Everything's put to rights. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And I think we know what he means when he says that.
And she saw that because she noticed the pattern coming from before in the Hebrew scriptures.
Luke is very careful. You know, all this language of when John the Baptist is prophet. I mean, we could talk about John the Baptist as a microcosmos of the Hebrew Bible. Is the prophecy about John the Baptist is quoting almost directly Malachi. Mm-hmm. Behold, I'm going to send you one in the spirit and the power of Elijah. And so she seems to be putting all this together somehow, that this isn't just a weird event that happened to her, but this is actually pulling together all God's political ambitions for the world to run it with righteousness and goodness and justice and mercy and peace. Then it's going to come through her, which is humbling to her. Mm-hmm. And again, it's this dawned on me in this reading of the Advent scriptures, is that again, it's a woman who is the first to really understand what's going on. And it's women who are the very first ones to see the resurrected Jesus and report it, even though nobody believed them. Mm-hmm. And maybe nobody would have believed Mary if she had said these things. In fact, it's probably good suspicion to think that nobody did believe her if she had told them these things. But she was treasuring these things up in her heart. She understood. Mm-hmm. And the song really shows that she understands how the Hebrew Bible has been preparing us for this child who will come rule and save through her. All right. I think that's enough
for
this one.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.